Welcome to Looks Like New, a show that asks old questions about new technology, brought to you by the Media Economies and Design Lab at CU Boulder. I'm your host, Stephanie Abdallah, and joining me on the program today is Dr. Nick Holdry, who is Professor Emeritus of Media Communications and Social Theory and Professorial Research Fellow in the Department of Media and Communications at the London School of Economics and Political Science. As a sociologist of media and culture, his work over the past two decades has been crucial in understanding how media and communications concentrate symbolic power and what that means for human solidarity. He is interested in how media and communication institutions and infrastructures contribute to various types of order, such as social, political, cultural, economic, and ethical. And more recently, he has focused his work on data questions, ethics, politics, and the deep social implications of big data and small data practices. Dr. Nick Holdry is the author or editor of 17 books, among them Data Grab, The New Colonialism of Big Tech and How to Fight Back, co-authored with Dr. Ulises Mejias, and The Space of the World, Can Human Solidarity Survive Social Media, and What If It Can't? Both published in 2024. In today's episode, Dr. Holdry and I will talk about the intricate relationship between media, power, and societal structures. Our discussion will include topics such as data colonialism, the importance of forging solidarities within and beyond academia, and the urgency of analyzing technologies through a critical lens. Dr. Holdry, welcome to Looks Like New, and thank you for joining us today. We're honored to have you to have this conversation with you.
Well, thank you very much, Stephanie. It's great to be with you, and of course, great to be back in Boulder.
That's awesome. Dr. Holdry, I cannot even begin to summarize how extensive and brilliant your career is. It feels like I wasn't even able to cover half of it in this introduction. So to start off, I'm interested in hearing, how do you like to introduce your work to people? And what drew you to these questions about media, power, and society?
Well, the first thing I got interested in at the beginning of my career was, why do we pay attention to media at all? After all, we could just turn our backs, couldn't we? Some people do. Why do we pay attention to it? Where does that idea that there's truth in media even come from? Where does that come from? What are its roots? Why do we trust these institutions that we call media? I'm not saying we shouldn't, but that has to come from somewhere. So if you like, from the beginning I was taking an anthropological take on how is this even possible, this thing we call media. And that led me in my earlier work to develop the idea that we have in every society today, something we call the myth of the mediated center, which is the myth that although in theory there could be many centers of society, or there might be none at all, we believe that somehow there's likely to be a bit more truth there in those central media institutions that we turn our bodies towards when we're looking for truth. But of course, I was writing about the era when, although the internet was coming into being, social media didn't yet exist. We had limited channels. We didn't have the alternative of listening to each other multiplied through social media. It was a different world entirely. So that myth has continued in new forms with social media. I call it the myth of us. It's the myth that it's really us who are speaking to each other on social media rather than a very particular type of us that Facebook allows to happen under very particular conditions, which is very constraining. A lot of things you can't do on social media, a lot of things you're incentivized to do that you might not otherwise do unless there was the incentive there. So I'm still interested in the same thing, but I guess what's changed in the past 10 or 15 years is through my own fieldwork talking to people about how they told stories, it became obvious that doing it through the medium of data was really important. You know, around about 2011 or 2012 in a poor part of Britain, we were interviewing people who were trying to capture people's voices in local communities, people with very few resources, But they wanted to speak, and these people wanted to hear them. How did they do that? And we found that the people running local websites of that sort were having to do something which was really new, which was they were having to take a story, put it on a website so that people would listen to it. It's translating it through the machine of data analytics. And then once they constructed the website so as many people as possible were rerouted to listen to this, then they had to translate again back out what they'd done into what they were trying to do in the first place, which was help these people speak. And we call that real social analytics. We stole the phrase from Adobe. They claim to have trademarked the phrase social analytics, but real people were doing this. And that's what got me into studying data itself, because when you think about it, there was a world before data in the sense we know it today. There's always been information, measures, of course. But we live in a world where everything you do, almost everything that's significant, is translated into counted data that is stored in a database potentially forever, and now, of course, is processable by AI. That only really became possible when you had a point-to-point connection of an internet, which really got going in the early 90s, effectively, for most people. And then when you started to have the capacity to store data, to process data, and these have only emerged in the past, 20 years. So we've lived through a complete transformation of what social life is. We still think we're doing the same things because we still have the same words in our language for it, but actually we're doing it under radically different conditions. And social media is just one of the weirdest versions of that. But pretty well everything we do is now converted into data. And once I started thinking about that, and I had a bit of a background in philosophy for my first degree, my undergraduate education, I realized this is a really philosophical question. This is really interesting. What happens when the world is itself, the very components of the world, start to be not just our bodies, what we do with our bodies, but data, which is radically different from our bodies. And so I guess that's what makes sense of me today studying big data and even AI, which is the book I'm working on right now, because that's the latest stage of this extraordinary transformation for good and, of course, perhaps for bad.
I appreciate you pointing to this evolution that sometimes feels quite organic to many of us, but might not be felt as organically, right? And considering that, your work, as you mentioned, moved from broadcast media to digital platforms and more recently researching AI systems, how has your thinking about media power changed as these technologies have transformed?
Well, I've always felt that the sort of power that's invested in media institutions is very poorly understood. It's massively important because it's literally the difference between people being invisible or being visible, between being able to be heard and not heard at all. Most people spend their whole lives never getting close to centralized media, never ever being heard. That's normal. It's the tiny minority of people who take it for granted that what they do is going to be heard and recorded. Social media appeared to change that, but it did it under very particular conditions, that you had to be heard only under the terms that led to Facebook and Meta being able to extract the profit from using your attention to attract advertisers, which turns out to be a very heavy price to pay, as we've finally started to learn, and we can talk about that book a bit more if you want. But it means that the stakes in understanding media power, the power in technological systems, become ever higher. I think they've got massively higher in the past 30 years since I've been starting to work on these issues. And now we're looking at a world where not only is what we do socially captured by platforms that extract profit from it, but also control the way it operates, the parameters, the things you can do, the things you can't do, the things you're incentivized to do, the things you're no longer incentivized to do and you forget to do. But now we're looking at a world where even the way we think, the way we solve a problem, how we ask a question, where we go when we don't know what to do, maybe who we ask for life advice, is now operating through devices captured in our phones and other things, which is AI, which is a product, which is being sold for money somewhere. And at the moment, there's an awful trillions of dollars of investment which needs eventually to be recouped. So this is a commercial product, the conditions under which we think, the way we operate in the world. And that is something we've just taken on board in the past 3 years, because it's nearly 3 years. It's 3 years this month since ChatGPT was released. But that is a very big change. You know, it's a change over what we define as knowledge, how we find out things about the world. Do we go to a person or no? Probably we don't now. We go to a device and type something in or speak something in. Think about a five-year-old child today. They're picking up on ChatGPT on their parents' devices. Every child has thousands of questions for their parents. What's this? Why does that work? Why isn't it this way? Are they still asking their parents those things, or are they asking it at ChatGPT? Supposing that becomes normal, how's that going to change their view of where knowledge is, what it looks like? Does it look like a human body? Does it look like a face that's opening its mouth rhythmically to say something back to you? Or does it look like a pop-up on a device or something you hear through a headphone and so on that isn't a human voice? And that raises big questions. We could get into some of those questions. We are literally working on the inside mechanism of how social life holds together at all. People take it for granted. Literally, we're in the engine room of social life itself, and some very powerful forces are controlling how we're doing that. It's not necessarily us who are making the choices right now.
Absolutely. And I definitely want to go back to AI. But before we do that, I feel like we could take a step back to talk more in depth about data colonialism, because I feel like that conversation informs these pressing matters and questions about AI right now, right? In your co-authored work with Dr. Mejias, you say that contemporary data extraction mirrors the colonialist logic of appropriating human life for economic value. And I'm wondering if you could unpack this idea for us a little bit more. And what is that data colonialism it extracts from us? And why is it particularly important to think about this extraction nowadays?
Well, yes, it's true. I jumped ahead to where we are now. And that's a sign of how fast things are moving.
Absolutely.
Even in 3 years, we're in a new stage of this unfolding history. The history of this idea of data colonialism, which Ulysses and I have been working on for nearly a decade now, is that we felt that there were certain things going on with the taking of data across almost every area of the society, education, health, the military, transport, you name it. Data is being captured. Everyone knows that. And the question is how to understand it. You can understand it as just a functional improvement of capitalism, making the system more efficient. That's certainly the way most corporations would understand it. Or you could think about the consequences of it in terms of power relations. Who has power over what types of information? Who has power over what gets done with that information? What sort of decisions become possible that were never even possible before, because data sets have been brought together? Incredible aspects of power are now operating through the medium of data. Now, again, you could just say, hey, this is just capitalism expanding. Yeah, there's power in capitalism. We know that. Big deal. We don't know what comes after capitalism, so why get so worked up about it? Well, someone like Shoshana Zuboff, whose early work we greatly admired, was at least saying, actually, there are real issues around privacy and other things like that you do have to take seriously. That's surveillance capitalism. Now, you might say, isn't that enough? It's been a very important concept. Why do we need more? Well, our hunch was that somehow to express everything in terms of those cases where we're under surveillance directly, whether our privacy is directly being infringed, wasn't the full extent of the problem. So there are many other areas of data being captured and creating power relations. Take Uber, for example. You want the data as to where you are and what your name is to be captured by you, but that's how you're going to get your ride. No problem there. The question is the relationship of data, tracking the driver, tracking your behavior with the driver, all these things, creates an enormous power relation in the city, which Uber takes advantage of, which puts it in a position that no transport company has ever been in history, right? So there are bigger issues involved in the use of data than just surveillance. And our idea, and we'll see why in the case of AI really brings this home in a moment, but our idea was that what's going on with data colonialism, the capturing of life through the form of data, isn't just an extension of colonialism. And there are two reasons for that. One is that when you think about it, there would have been no capitalism without colonialism. We forget that. It's very convenient to forget that. But it was because pretty well the whole world as it was then known was taken by two European powers, Spain and Portugal, and then the English took in and took all the money, and the Dutch in the meantime were pretty effective too, taking the whole world. That idea that the whole world was there to be taken was literally astonishing to people in the 16th century. They could not get their heads around it. They debated for 50 years in Spain whether this was okay, was it ethical, was it all right to take the land of Christians, to murder them, to rape them? Was that okay because they were potential Christians? They agonized for half a century about that until they decided it was okay. So colonialism was an extraordinary transformation in history. And the wealth, the unimaginable wealth that was taken at that time, was the beginnings of the field that made anything like capitalism possible. And some historians remember that and a lot forget it. So once you bring that onto the table and then you remember that colonialism didn't disappear in the 19th century, it actually went on. The slave plantations were making an awful lot of money and fueling the cotton factories in Britain. They were all part of the same thing. So colonialism and capitalism went on together. It didn't stop in the 20th century, even though some of the empires collapsed. That power, that unequal power, still shapes the global economy to this day. And, of course, it's fueled the racism in our societies, which we're living the consequences of this to this day. So colonialism has never really gone away, although some of its imperial forms fell away. But that then leads to a very simple question. Well, if that's true, why would we think that colonialism has stopped evolving? We don't think that capitalism has stopped evolving. So why would colonialism have stopped evolving? So that gave us the idea that alongside the evolution of capitalism, certain refinement of techniques of extraction and profit-making, there was a possibility that was a really new stage of what colonialism is at its root about, which is the taking of everything, the appropriation of everything for small elites, the whole world just there for the taking. And when you think about the way our lives have been datified in the past 30 years, that was actually a much better framework for understanding the full scope of what's going on. But there was a period when, before AI came on board and generative AI, when it was quite easy to go either way. Zuboff offered a good model. We offered a counter model. We didn't disagree, but ours, we tried to add something. But as Ulysses and I were writing our second book, which is for a general audience, it's for Penguin in the UK and Chicago Press in the North America, ChatGPT came out in November 22, and we were halfway through writing this book, and we thought, well, should we stop? Does it make everything we've done irrelevant? Because no one knew in the first week or so what the hell is going on here. But after a week, we decided, actually, we're going to double down. This is exactly what we had in mind. Think about it. Shoshana Zuboff says that what's exploited in surveillance capitalism is surveillance assets. When you're under surveillance, suppose you make a beautiful song and you're so proud of it, you want to put it online. That's exactly when you are not under surveillance. You're proud it's out there, right? You're proud of that. That's the opposite of surveillance, but that's equally an input to the AI machine. And OpenAI, just 1 year later, in September 23, gave evidence to the UK House of Lords where they said the cutting-edge AI models cannot function without taking copyrighted material. It's like a thief coming to your house and saying, you've got some great stuff here. I like it. I can make money out of it. Now, would you mind just accepting that my business model requires me taking everything you've got? You're not going to say that's not okay, are you? I know it's against the law, but come on, let's think about the future. I just want to take everything, and that's my business model. We would probably not be convinced by that. Yeah. But somehow, many people in society are convinced by that. It's technically illegal. Okay, there are legal cases going through the courts at the moment. But this is truly an astonishing thing that's gone on here. Now, you might say the analogy is not completely exact, because when stuff is taken for an AI model, it's still there. The Margaret Atwood novel is still there in the form. However, it's been simulated in a form that maybe it will be easy to produce Margaret Atwood-like novels at some point in the future. What does that do to our view of Margaret Atwood? What does it do to her sense of what she spent her whole life trying to achieve? What does it do to the very idea that the reason she created a Margaret Atwood novel was because there was nothing like it before? That is the point of art and creativity. So you see, there's only one model in history that's big enough to make sense of that audacious taking of everything, and that is colonialism. That's what it did. It said, this is your life. This is your way of life. It's great, but we're going to take it because we have a right to take it, because our business model requires us to take it, and there's nothing you can do. And we genuinely believe that the history of colonialism, particularly the initial land grab of colonialism, which we call now the data grab, is the only really historical model that fully gets to the full scope of what has just gone on, literally in everyone's lifetime, within the past 3 years. So that's why we think it's an important perspective, and goes on being more important the more AI's audacity goes on growing.
I appreciate you unpacking this concept for us so thoroughly. While it feels extremely accurate to characterize data grabbing and all its harmful consequences as colonial practices, I wonder about the limits and the possibilities of this comparison. And when I'm saying this, I'm thinking about the settler colonial structures that are still in place today, right? Could the understanding of data colonialism as a new form of colonialism risk relegating appropriation of land, epistemicide, and the genocide of marginalized communities to the past? Or does data colonialism contribute to shedding light on these current settler colonial practices?
Certainly, what you just said was the worry that some people have when we develop the idea. It's a confrontational concept, obviously. It's deeply provocative, particularly for those people who suffered more than I have in my life from the consequences of colonialism. I grew up in London, which is a beneficiary. Ulysses is a Mexican. He lives in the States now, but he grew up in Mexico, so he knows about the nature of colonialism. He still lives its consequences today. But I would never have dared write this book on my own as a white person from London, let's be clear. But I absolutely believe in the concept and its relevance. So what we're saying is that this is a new stage of colonialism. It's not as if the past has gone away. If we emphasize the fact it is precisely not gone away, and the new possibilities build on the past, right? The fact that Facebook, Meta as it now is, could claim at one stage, they've abandoned this now, to go in and offer Facebook free basics to 30 African countries to say, hey, this is the internet, this is for you, you haven't got much, so take our internet. It's only 5 channels, as it were, but Facebook is at the core of it, and that's fine, isn't it? That was, of course, only possible because of the past history of colonialism. But if we literally freeze colonialism at a point in time and say the only colonial way of thinking And the only colonial act of taking everything that we're going to pay attention to is what happened up to, let's say, 1960 or wherever we stopped the clock, then we are risking that possibility that something as audacious is going on in our lifetime. Now, of course, there are many differences. And so we really stress this every time we talk. We are not saying that what's going on today in our 21st century world, which has so many, almost everything is different from the world of 1492. We're not saying, therefore, that everything is the same. That would be absurd. What we're saying is that two things remain continuous, and they're the core. One is the taking of everything. The second is the sense it's okay to take everything. In fact, it's right to take everything. It's justified by a business model, by a colonial power, a vision of the future, and so on. And I think once one drills down to those core things, without, of course, not taking seriously the differences, but those are important continuities. So it means some things are not continuous. When I give up data on my phone through an app, or when a song that I've made is taken by a large language model, no one is physically attacking my body in the way that bodies were atrociously dismembered in historical colonialism. Of course, that's not the same. But there's also a very interesting reason why we wouldn't expect it to be the same. And that is this, that historically, when the world was taken by Spain and Portugal, they didn't even know there was a new world to be taken originally. They found people who they just about recognized as people. They had literally no relationship with them. There was nothing to build from at all. And of course, there was no history of colonialism or capitalism. It was the start of a new era. Now we are living on the basis of 5 centuries of colonialism, 3.5 centuries of capitalism. We all know what terms and conditions mean. We know you click accept if you want the product. No violence is necessary most of the time, which is not to say that people aren't violently damaged by the data around them, but those are the special cases, not the general case. So the conditions are different, but that deep continuity, taking everything and thinking that's okay because you have a colonial mentality, which means it's okay for you to take it. Those are deep continuities. Take someone like Sam Altman, the way he speaks about the world that he's building. It's so easy to find parallels between the way he speaks and the way colonial colonizers who took everything spoke. Elon Musk is manifestly done some pretty colonial things recently. The parallels are right out there. We just need to see them and think about the consequences.
Thank you for that. And a call that you and Dr. Mejias make in the book is towards the importance of decolonial thinking to expose and dismantle these structures of data colonialism. And I feel like this is the 1 million question right here. But what does it look like to decolonize data?
Well, it's a massive question, because if we were right that this is a new stage of colonialism and colonialism itself was one of the biggest moments in history, the history of humanity, the taking of everything by small elites and then the reordering everything around that taking of everything, and all sorts of narratives to make sense of that and rationalize that, the whole history of British history for the past, said making sense of all this. Resisting that is a huge thing. It's not something an individual can do. It's a whole order. However, that doesn't mean to say resistance is impossible. And by the way, if none of us knows what comes after capitalism, we do have some sense of what comes after some aspects of colonialism, because we saw it happen in the 1960s when colonial power was toppled. And we saw aspects of the civil rights movement in the U.S. where some aspects of the racism in the U.S. was addressed. So we have more sense of how to address that than perhaps than even with capitalism, but that's one way of looking at it anyway. But clearly it's very complex. It has to be collective resistance. And we draw in the book on a model developed by Latin American activists for thinking about how to face down the power of the way that capitalism has worked in Latin America. And they talk about resistance that works with the system, resistance that works against the system, and then resistance that works beyond the system. And I think it's a powerful model. So against the within the system is what's going on with inside the big tech industries today. There are a lot of people inside the tech industry who are deeply unhappy with what's going on. People have been sacked from Google for speaking their minds. People have walked out of Meta and become whistleblowers and reveal what's going on. There's a lot of resistance within the system. And if you like, one could talk about what regulators do. It's sort of within the system. There's a system to regulate tech. It's more powerful in Europe than it is in the US right now, but it is within the system. The system as it operates. Antitrust, whatever. Then you've got resistance against the system, which deliberately confronts some of what big tech are doing, challenges the injustices of the AI models or what social media are doing, some of the cruelty to young people, challenge it head on. Law cases against Facebook by various states in America. Many that's against the system, directly confronting it. That's not business as usual because it's fronting the fundamental principles. Alternatively, people setting up new platforms. Drivers in New York have set up a new driving platform where they remain in control, not Uber, not Lyft. That's against the system. Then, really important, given how big colonialism is resistance beyond the system. If it were just those first two, our chances of defeating that something that big would be small because the system is almost infinitely large. But that's where our imagination comes in. And this is where colonial history, decolonial history is very important. The biggest power has always had to be fought through the imagination, first of all, through the mind, not just the body. There may be no capacity for the body to resist under certain conditions of absolute power. But the mind has that capacity to imagine a different future, a future not as dictated to you by those who have power over you. And we believe that is the starting point for imagining claiming back our time from all the time we spend on social media, claiming back our spaces so that we're in control of the parameters, not someone who's written some software to try and, you know, nudge what we're doing in space. People are doing this. People are trying to spend less time with their phones. There are battles in many countries to take the smartphones out of schools. Probably that's not going to be the answer to the question. But then there are people trying to ban social media from the under 16s. Again, maybe that's not you make the drug more attractive by banning it. Maybe we have to take the power ourselves and say collectively, are we sure we're going in the right direction? If we're really sure we're not, why aren't we getting together to actually change this? And there are social media platforms, for example, that are not for profit. There are options, and we have to start helping each other imagine a different future, and that's resistance beyond the system.
Thank you so much. This gives me a lot of hope, actually, and it leads me to ask about Tierra Común alongside professors Paola Ricaurte and Ulises Mejías. You created this network of Latin American activists, citizens, and scholars who want data to be decolonized. Can you tell us the story of this project and what you hope to accomplish with it?
Yeah, I'm delighted to. It's a trilingual website and network, Spanish, Portuguese, and English. So English, not the dominant language, obviously. It came about because just before the pandemic, Ulises and I were in Mexico City doing our first talks in Spanish about our book and our concept, and it went well, and I was excited, and I naively said to Paola, our host in Mexico City, hey, this is great. Let's do more of it. I want to go to many other countries in Latin America. Let's do more. And she sat down and looked at me as we were having dinner and said, we can't afford to do that here. Latin American scholars haven't got the money to be flying around in Latin America. There are reasons in terms of the airlines and who controls those airlines, why those prices are out of the reach of people in Latin America. I was really shaken by that because I come from Europe where it's just basic. You fly around. You know, you go to wherever in Europe you feel like for your holiday to meet friends. It's just normal. Everyone's doing. And I realized, I thought I knew something about Latin America. I thought I was, as it were, very sympathetic, but I realized I didn't even understand this basic thing about it. And we decided that night that this was intolerable. This just couldn't be accepted. So why not create a website where we could all go, those who care about this idea, activists and academics, if we can imagine a recording being made in a village in Bolivia. All you need is a device that can upload data and the recording, like we're doing just now, to the website where you create it, and then something has been added, hasn't it? And you start to create something. But this was November 22, right? November 2019. And we didn't know that the pandemic was coming. Of course, like most academics, we didn't get around to building the website until April 2020. When we realized we had to build something because none of us knew at that point whether we were ever going to meet again. We didn't know vaccines were coming. We didn't know the pandemic was going to end. No one knew. So we decided we had to build something. We built the Tierra Común website with help from my institution, LSE. And we started adding people to it, mainly Latin American, but not exclusively. There were people in the States, people from Africa who are members of it. But the key idea is to create a space that is completely without hierarchy, that allows people to come together who share the same values. And originally we just had online meetings because that's all we could do. But gradually, from December 22 onwards, we started meeting in person. There was a meeting just last month in Rio, which sadly I couldn't get to, but many people did. So we're just trying to create the energy of a movement that is where people can go and meet and talk about these ideas and know they can be listened to. It's not funded by any corporation or any institution. It's sort of self-funded. And people find a way to get there because it matters. And we try and meet in Latin America in ways around other conferences that somehow it's viable for enough people to get there. And we record what we do. So we're trying to create a horizontal movement that can give some sort of hope that a different world could be built. Because what does the word Tierra Común mean? It means in Spanish common earth, common territory. But it's not necessarily like the physical earth. It's that space we imagine where you and I, though we don't know each other, could come together and we could start talking and we start doing something. It's our common place of possibility. That's what it's about. And it's lasted 5 years and we have over 100 members. And it's one of the things I'm most proud of because we didn't know what it was going to be. We didn't design it or make it a certain way. We just knew we had to create something under those conditions. And it has become what the network wants it to be through people's energies. They put the energy in. And there are not many sources of hope in the world today, but this is, for us, one of those. And we try and share the story with as many people as we can and link to indigenous movements and other things that are going on, draw on their wisdom, publicize them, and it has started to have impact, and people recognize it as a real thing because it's endured. And it's a sign that resistance can endure, and once it starts to endure, it can mean something. And a recent film that I saw, which of course I will not plug or recommend you watch in any particular way, but one battle after another, for me, sums up what this whole conversation has been about. I'm not going to spoil it for you by saying why I say that, but I would encourage you to consider viewing it.
Thank you so much for the recommendation. And I'm absolutely thrilled to hear about Tierra Común. And as I was telling you earlier, as a fellow Latin American activist and scholar, I would be very interested in eventually contributing to this project and conversation. But for now, I think this is a great segue to talking about the relevance of bridging academic work with knowledge produced elsewhere. Just to situate our audience, Dr. Coldry was invited by the Department of Media Studies here at CU Boulder to lead a couple of events. And the day before the recording of this episode, I had the pleasure of attending a workshop in which we discussed the stakes of academic voice. Dr. Coldry. You talked about strategies and new resources that must be implemented in order for us to continue producing critical work within the academy. And among them, you mentioned listening to people who are producing critical work outside the university. What has been your experience with these this practice, and what can academia both gain and offer in this relationship?
Well, it's a very complicated question, and although I'm someone who's been to the U.S. probably 50 times in my life, probably spent 2 years of my life here, and I love it in the U.S., and particularly Boulder, I'm not pretending I can come here and preach to you about what you should be doing in these very difficult times. But on the other hand, it's important to show solidarity. Awful lot of people in the U.K. care an awful lot about the recent history of the U.S. And therefore, I wanted to come, and from the privilege of my distance, not being in the so close to what's going on, to offer a few thoughts. We won't get into the detail of what I said, but one key thing for me that's really important is to stop taking for granted the space we have in the university. Some people argue that universities are very unpopular and they've lost their way. Maybe certain mistakes have been made. But a recent survey in the U.S. found that there was majority support for universities continuing and continue to do what they're doing. There was not hostility. There were certain groups who feel doubts, but there was a majority support. But it's clear that this is something that's now highly contested. This is an issue at the core of a lot of federal politics. So it cannot be ignored. And what I think it's worth considering doing is opening the doors of the university more through events to draw people in, to say, what we have here is something we want to share. Yes, of course, some of it is written in technical language for certain purposes, and you have to work hard to understand what it's about. That's the nature of science. That's the nature of philosophy or whatever. But that's not everything we do. There are other things we talk about that we want everyone to share. They're about the values of society. It's about why we value imagination, why we want to read books, why we believe in the importance of reading books or developing ideas, thinking about alternative ways of organizing things, markets, institutions, or whatever. This is what we do inside a university. We want you to come in and listen to that. And that's something at LSC we've always had 4 or 5 public lectures every night for decades. And we still do today. Other places where I go, I always ask, are you going to get people who aren't from the university in to hear the lecture? And I try increasingly in the past 5 years, and this came out of the experience of doing the work on data colonialism and the fact that it was obviously an idea not just for a book. It needed activism. It needed to build a movement to try and find a language that anyone could listen to. Not everyone wants to hear it, but at least they'd have a chance. They wouldn't be kept out by jargon, by difficult words, by difficult ways of expressing things that just put off the person who hasn't had the privilege of the education I've had. So I've been changing my style. The book Data Grab was written for a general audience. It is written for really anyone. Penguin were great in changing some of our habits and making us talk in a more direct way, telling the story. The book, The Space of the World, that you also kindly mentioned, which is about how we need to change social media to make it more livable, that's written for a general audience. You don't need any academic knowledge at all to read it. It's written for a general audience. The book I'm trying to finish now on AI is also written for a general audience, although that's pretty hard because AI has some very technical aspects and it's not easy to write about. I can't say it's easy, but I'm trying because I think the transformations that we're living today in the past 20, 30 years that I started with are literally changes to the very core of society. And we're all living the consequences. So it's very important to have shared frameworks for making sense of them. And its universities need to share those ideas. They must not be locked within our walls. because otherwise they're not going to be effective. Because if we're going to have a better digital world, one that is less toxic, more healthy, we all have to work together to build that. So there's a reason for changing style. It's not because I want to sell lots of books, but that might be nice. It's because these ideas are ones that have to be shared. And I hope that people listening to this will feel able to look out for those books and find them approachable and start talking about the ideas with their family and friends, because that is the conversation we want to start. But that requires changing how we talk, how we think, and how we reach out to people.
And since you mentioned the space of the world and also solidarity, there are two important questions that you were asking in the title of the book, right? Can solidarity survive social media? And what if it can't? To which conclusions have you arrived when investigating these questions?
Well, I'm not the first person to say there are some problems with social media. In fact, it's pretty well universal to think that it didn't all work out well with social media. That is, with the commercial social media we have. I am not against connecting with people. I'm not against digital platforms. We had a choice. 20 years ago, having been through the first 10 years of the internet, when there was an awful lot of bad porn circulating, an awful lot of flaming, we used to call it, people insulting each other, getting polarized in listservs, they used to call them, email groups, basically. People could see that if once you connect everyone up, since there's a certain percentage of bad stuff out there in the world, you're going to have a problem. So there was a choice around about 2004 when Facebook was set up. Let's perhaps build ways of bringing people together that manage that problem, that build some fire breaks in to stop the bad stuff spreading super fast. Don't incentivize it to spread. Yes, you may make my money out of it spreading, but don't incentivize that because that's bad for all of us. Well, what did social media do? They did none of those things. They actually built polarization machines that incentivize people to say, I like that person, which means I don't like that person, to I hate that because I like that, and so on. They incentivized that. They created a polarization machine because that was the basis for making money. So we made a fundamental error 20 years ago that we allowed businesses, quite legitimately wanting profit, to do something that no one had ever done in history before, which was design what they called the space of the world, the space of all possible spaces where we are social. Imagine if a king or an emperor in, I don't know, 1650 or 1930 had been given the power to design the space of all possible spaces where we can be social. They would have said, thank you. That's what I've been waiting for. But they never said that because they were never asked, because no one imagined it was even possible. It wasn't possible until around about 2004. Then it became possible, and we delegated that extraordinary power to the people who were only caring about profit. They claimed to be wanting to connect us, but they wanted to make profit out of that. That was a fundamental mistake we made then. We should never have delegated the design of the social world to people who want to make profit. But we did. And the consequences of that is all the issues with young people's mental health, issues around polarized politics in almost every country, decline in trust in facts, and the disruption of how kids grow up. Kids grow up by being protected from the adult world, bad as it often is, by boundaries around what's out there that protect them from it. We took all those boundaries away with social media. We made almost every mistake of social design we could have done in the space of about 5 years. And now we're living the consequences. In other words, what I'm saying in the book is we built the wrong space of the world, and therefore we have to build a better one. And that's going to be hard because we never knew how to build one in the first place until we let the wrong people do it. But there are ways of doing it. There are nonprofit social media which are out there. There are ways of changing the scale of social media. It's called the Fediverse, and Mastodon is part of it. It's not taking off yet, but maybe because we haven't tried hard enough and there's not enough help to those platforms. Solidarity comes in because solidarity is basically doing difficult things, incurring costs, doing stuff that it costs you a lot to do, like changing how we recycle, changing the the fuel we use, all these things that cost us. We don't want to do it, but doing it because in solidarity with others, how we, this is why I wrote the book, how will we face the climate emergency unless we do things we don't want to do in sync with others? There is no other way of defining what the solution looks like, but that is what solidarity is. So the simple question is, will we be more likely to have solidarity in a world where there's no trust in each other, where everyone is feeling polarized from each other, where kids don't grow up the right way? No. We are going to have to fix this rabbit hole that we built for ourselves, the commercial social media, before we have a chance of getting onto what should be our real problem, which is the climate emergency and certain other things going on in our societies, which are also pretty big. But at the moment, we've messed up and we have to get this local problem sorted out before we move on to the bigger issues. So that's why I say I'm not without hope. There are alternatives, but we have to face the problem and name it as our problem. We built the wrong space of the world. We need to build a better one. Together we have a chance of doing so, as long as we remain clear about what we're trying to do.
Thank you for that. And a personal curiosity of mine, because I have not read the book yet, was to indeed understand what you meant by the space of the world.
Yeah.
So thank you for clarifying that. Since we are ending this conversation with notes of hope, I'd like to hear about the alternatives you've encountered in your career that motivated you to continue producing critical work about media, power, and society. And especially right now, what are practices that give you hope?
Well, first of all, as I said, the imagination. I do believe. Think of the end of slavery. Think of the civil rights movement. Only through the power of the imagination was it possible to face down the brutal violence that was the norm. Somehow people had to imagine a different world. I wasn't part of that. I have to learn from that history. So imagination is really powerful. It's the root of any struggle. And secondly, imagination requires some clarity about what is being faced. Some struggles, it's very obvious what is wrong and what has to be fought. Others are more complicated. Society is super complex. The way technology works requires a lot of work to understand it. You may need to go to university to find out a bit of some of the subtlety of how this power works. Okay, so there's a role for critical academic work that tries to explain things and see where the power really lies, which is very often not what we're told. Because part of the way power works is by telling a different story that covers its tracks, that disguises what's really going on, just so that it can go on doing what it wants to do without being seen doing what it wants to do. So there's a real role for critical work, but there's also a key role for building things. For 25 years, I've been interested in what used to be called alternative media, media outside the mainstream, small radio stations, small music labels, whatever, just saying it can be done another way. Yes, it's small scale, but what's wrong with small scale? What's wrong with small scale? I'm living small scale. My life is small scale. Life is small scale. And this idea in the book is resonance. Silicon Valley tells us everything has to scale. Otherwise, it's not real. Why? Because the only way you make maximum money is on maximum scale. Do you scale a party to have a good party? No, you exactly do not scale it. Scale it a little bit, but absolutely not beyond a certain point. That's the whole point of what a party is, right? It wouldn't be a party if 7.2 billion people were finding out where the party was. So scalability isn't a good principle. A good principle, though, is resonance. That you want there to be many parties in the world, resonating with each other, enjoying the start of the millennium or the eclipse, resonating with each other, operating on similar principles, trusting each other to be doing their thing somewhere else, not scaled. But knowing you're in touch enough to know there is that resonance, which feels good. Resonance is a much better way to build. And I had to work on that principle, but I think it gives me some hope because it's not as if I invented resonance. We all know good resonance and bad resonance. Feedback in a studio is horrible, right? But we know good resonance, where I'm listening to you and you're listening to me and it's not feeding back and we're each in our own space and it feels good. It's not as if I've invented that. That is the way we've done things for a very long time. And let me just end with one final hope, point of hope, a book that inspired me a lot, Ulysses and Me, as we wrote The Cost of Connection, by a great Indigenous activist from Canada called Leanne Betamasoake Simpson, who wrote a book about the Indigenous experience of resisting colonialism, which, of course, still goes on in Canada and in the U.S. And the book is called As We Have Always Done.
I love that book.
So it's not as if we don't know what we should be doing. It's just very hard to do it and see that clearly, because it does mean some changes. And we have to help each other with that. But As We Have Always Done is a way to look to the future with some hope, because we know it can be done. We know we can face down what seems to be inevitable, what trillions of dollars are invested in telling us inevitable, and it will be inevitable. And still, we start stopping it and saying no. And we can start right now.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kovdri, for dedicating your time, for dedicating your knowledge. It's been an absolute pleasure to discuss these very important matters with you. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Stephanie.
You have been listening to Looks Like New on KGNU's It's the Economy. Looks Like New is a show that asks all the questions about new technology, coming to you from the Media Economies Design Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder, and is produced by Alexander Lipka. You can find us on the fourth Thursday of every month on air or online at lookslikenew.net or wherever you get your podcasts. We hope you'll join us next month. Thank you for listening.